down south.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Is your host Andrew Horowitz here? How are you? Hope you had a good week. It's been a rough week. It is more than a rough week. It was a horrifying week, wasn't it? It was when people seemingly came back to the trading desks with a vengeance, wanting to get out of whatever they could to get out of the way of what was apparently forming as a colossal, gigantic, obscene level of bearishness that had been brought about by a tremendous amount of reports that were showing the economy slowing, unemployment rising, credit issues mounting. And overall, it was just a horrible affair from start to finish. The markets, aside from Friday, Friday actually changed the game a little bit. But aside from Friday, the market was down about 3% overall. And it was very difficult on almost every sector. It was really kind of difficult. But I will tell you, something interesting happened on Friday. We're going to get into that in a second. And it was kind of interesting that the market started to turn midday before we even had any official understanding of what was going to happen. But we'll get to that in a second. We have today, I'm going to give a call and a chat with Jason Calacanis. He is a gentleman that many of you know. He's very well known in the technology world for his, he really was the one that started the web blogs and he's been very involved with AOL. He is the inventor and the founder of Mahalo. He is a regular on Twit, and I had the opportunity to, or at least I'm going to have the opportunity to spend some time with him. I had the opportunity actually to spend some time with him on Twit recently. About 4 weeks ago with Leo Laporte. I was up in the California region and spent some time there and had a really good time on that. If you haven't heard it, it was the episode entitled, I think it was called, Cream Daddies? Puff Daddies? No, I don't know. It was about these cream puffs. And go over to twit.tv and you can check out all of the great podcasts over at Leo Laporte Land. Leoville, if you will. John Dvorak, Leo Laporte, Jason Calacanis, and, of course, Mac Break Weekly and all that great stuff over there. But anyway, let's talk about this before we get, kind of online with him. Because some of the things that happened last week, I think, really had people disturbed. I know that I got a lot of emails and people asked me, like, what to do now? What's happening? Where are we going? I mean, I could tell you that I think that we all know, and for all of us that have been kind of doing this thing for some time, whether you're listening to me in terms of just information or taking any of my advice, whatever you're doing is fine. But, I've been very negative for some time. If you're very concerned about many of the internals of this market, they really look to be breaking down for some time. I had, looked at the oil situation. If you had been in Doug, you made a bunch of money last week up about, last week was up about 10-12% for the week. We have a profit of approaching about 60% right now in the DUG ETF. We picked it up anywhere from 26 to 29, depending on where you were in the fold with our clients. And we also were short MasterCard, which we had about a 15-point drop last week. I wrote an article called Why I'm Short MasterCard for the MSN Money Strategy Lab. And in the Strategy Lab, again, until Friday, I was the only one that was really up all week. We managed to squeak out about a 2%, 2.5% gain for the week and actually went positive for most of the week until Friday afternoon came. And then all of a sudden, things changed, obviously from a leak in the news vine. Somebody knew that there was going to be something brewing. It's kind of interesting because I'll tell you what happened. It's serious. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, about 3:30, 4 o'clock or so, I was Twittering. I have this Twitter group with the MSN Money, some of the writers there, and we go back and forth. What are you writing? What's going on? Kind of what are you thinking about? Just to kind of get some ideas of what's happening with the market and from an investment standpoint and strategy as well as really coming up with some good ideas to blog. And I had this overwhelming feeling at about 3:30 or so. I said, you know what? This is like one of those weekends. It seems to be that things are, you got the political and presidential initial conventions over. We have the nominees already and primed. We have kind of the after the Labor Day and traders are back in drove and they're ready to trade and obviously they're feeling pretty pretty lousy right now, and they're in a real foul mood, it seemed, okay? And I said, there's just something in the air, something. And wouldn't you know it, lo and behold, we get this speculation, which turned out to be a little more than speculation right now, that Paulson is planning, the Treasury is planning to take control of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Something is in the air, and all of a sudden, when this popped, after hours, Fannie and Freddie dropped about 30%, realizing the shareholders realizing that this is a really bad thing, because the probability is that the Treasury is going to do something which is going to dilute shareholder value, because they're not just going to take over Fannie and Freddie Mac, you know, the largest mortgage suppliers in the country. They're not just going to take them over and simply allow for have a cash infusion, if you will. The stakes are way too big, and frankly, the numbers are way out of whack. We're talking in the hundreds of billions of dollars of potential failures right now on trillions of dollars of mortgages. You know, some estimates say that a simple 3% of default would amount to about $150 billion of failures between Fannie and Freddie. And the government needs to step in to do something. The question is, you know, do we want them to? And what I mean by that is, yes, we want a bailout in terms if it doesn't hurt us, right? I mean, we want a bailout if it doesn't cost us. We want a bailout if it doesn't bother us. We want a bailout if it's good for all of us. But that's just not possible, is it? I don't think so. The fact is that when you look at a bailout, what we're going to find is that it's going to hurt us either in taxes. It's going to hurt the shareholders dramatically. And the question is really right now, the common shareholders, we are being told, at least speculatively, that it's going to totally wipe them out. I mean, absolutely wipe out Fannie and Freddie. So if you're holding that and you're listening to this before Monday morning, and in fact, we do see the Treasury come in and take control either in a conservatorship or just outright just take them out, it looks like the common stocks are going to be history. If you have a put, good job. Well done. If, in fact, you're long, you have a problem, and that's a big problem. And really, you know, that you need to be concerned. The bonds, if you have bonds, many people have the bonds of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. You know, those seem to be, they're probably going to be okay. As a matter of fact, better than okay. They're going to be part of the backstop because the bond holders are the one that really bring in the juice, the cash, to fund the mortgages. You can't get rid of them. But the big question is, the big swing, is the $36 or $40 billion of preferred stocks that are outstanding right now with Fannie and Freddie. Because the problem is that if under, there's many different types of plans that can come here. And all these things, by the way, I'm talking to you on the weekend here, and I'm going to put this up earlier than I usually do. But the fact of the matter is that we don't know what's actually going to come out of this. I will tell you that I'm not in favor of a bailout. I'm not in favor of a bailout, not only because we're relatively short the market, neutral to short, but I'm not in favor of a bailout because I know it's going to hurt us long term. It's going to help us from a market standpoint, right? It's going to make sure that we have the underpinnings of a solid market, and it's going to help the housing. That's good. I'm totally in favor of that. My concern is, what is that going to mean? What is that going to mean? I mean, how much is it going to cost us? How much is it going to really be the long-term effect of this? And we did see the bailout of Bear Stearns, for example. We saw a rally ensue immediately afterwards and right afterwards as we really, you know, the confusion was gone. That's the big factor here. The confusion is gone. Markets hate confusion. They hate uncertainty. We know that. So right now what we have is a situation where the preferred stocks, which, by the way, the biggest problem with the preferred stocks, here's the problem. Many of the banks out there are owners of the preferred stocks. They did infusions. Remember that? You know, when Lehman or Citi or Bank of America, when they brought in capital, how did they bring it in? They brought it in the form of preferreds. Now, here's the problem. If all these other banks out there need money, if they need to keep on bringing in money to keep them solvent, right? Think about this. And the Treasury goes, rescues these two companies, but totally obliterates the preferreds and the common. Who in their right mind, what country, what individual, what hedge fund, who is going to do any further infusions into the preferred stocks of these companies? That's a huge problem. So on one hand, we get this backstop and this great feeling that there's going to be a solution at hand. On the other side of the coin, we have a huge unknown, because now does the government come in and rescue everybody? No way. Absolutely not. Something has to be done here. I'm not so sure it's the government's place right now to bail out this situation. Do you? I mean, on one, again, there's many, many, many different sides to this. But from an economic standpoint, from a standpoint globally in terms of markets and keeping the markets stable, I gotcha. Great. But for you and me, it stinks. Stinks to high hell. The whole thing stinks, by the way. There's no solution that works here. So I think that there may be an interim time period here that's going to be good for the markets. But at the same time, I think that if we do see a rally, you need to watch for the roll. You know what the roll is, right? Look at a chart. Watch a rally. And all of a sudden, you see the top start rolling over. You can look at it, and it gets this smooth look to it, where all of a sudden the top end starts rolling over. Now, we've seen a rally in the banks for the last few weeks here, or a general rally for many of them, even though we saw another bank taken out on Friday by the FDIC. Silver Star, I believe, I think it was Nevada, it was taken out. But the reason why we have seen such a build here is that Paulson looks like he's going to really come in and do this bailout. Now, I will tell you that many of the pundits, many of the speculators that are going right now and talking about this, they may be very wrong about this, and there may be another thing up their sleeve, because at the same time that we talk about this, you know, Paulson has been talking about for forever that he is not in favor of utilizing any of the government's money, that's the original discussion at least, to do any kind of bailout. So now we're in this weird situation. We're in this kind of really open area. So what do we do? Well, right now, I think you got to kind of watch and see. I mean, if you want to get in, you want to be really aggressive and buy, you know, some of the ETFs, the double ETFs on the financials, that may be interesting. But I think you need extreme caution, because what's going to happen now is you're going to see a whipsaw on the markets. As a matter of fact, after hours, many of the banks were up on Friday. We saw Citibank up 5% or so. We saw Bank of America. We saw the brokers, Merrill, Lehman. They all started moving up. But the thing also is that they started moving up midday. I scratch my head constantly and wonder who let the information out, right? I mean, why did these markets that were down so dramatically during the early part of the day with such horrible news in terms of our, you know, we had two or three economic reports come out, and it was the unemployment rate again, and it was just awful, just absolutely awful. And now we are very much resigned to the fact that this housing situation is worse than it was back in the Depression. It is very clear that the numbers are much bigger. They're just much more problems at hand. So with that in mind, the good news is that our portfolios in general, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, was up about 3% for the week, even though the markets went the other way. We picked up a couple of new positions at the end of the week that were making all of our Quanta fund, the Techna. We hit the quantitative, which is the screens. We hit the fundamentals, which they came through, you know, making good earnings, at least 25% a year. You know, the PE ratio, PEG ratios were good, and on and on. And then they made it through the technical analysis, and we picked up a couple of positions. And right now, as a matter of fact, we picked them early in the day on Friday as the market was tailing off, and they came back nicely, about 2.5%, 3% on the positions on Friday. We also went on a strategy lab and shorted Capital One Financial additionally, about where it is now, maybe a little bit lower than it is now on the day. What we did was, it was interesting because one of the flaws in the strategy lab that I have found is that you can't trade whenever you want. So I had to put the trades in the day before, and I have to actually have some advanced knowledge of what I'm going to be doing. I have to think through, okay, if the markets do this, well, I don't know what's going to happen, right? So what I have to do is at least give myself a fighting chance. So, for example, when I want to short Capital One, most people in the strategy lab do a buy or sell or a short at the open, 9:30 in the morning. I said, I'm not doing that. Too many things are happening at 9:30 in the morning. So I found out and I asked, listen, can I do a time-based buy? They said, sure. So what I did with Capital One is I said, after 10:30 at this price, I want you to short 100 shares additionally of Capital One Financial. And sure enough, if I would have shorted at the open, I probably shorted somewhere around 41, give or take 41, of course, something like that on Friday. I waited until after 10:30, the market started rallying, and guess what? I shorted about 44, I believe it was, 44 and a quarter, I believe it was, $3 differential. And the reason why I did that was, the first time that I shorted Capital One in the strategy lab, I did it like I thought I had to do it. And you know what? I was off 8%. We're up on Capital One. In our real portfolios, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, we're up. In the Harvest Company Strategy, we're up. But we're not up when it comes to the strategy lab, and that's because we didn't do a time base. And it took me a long time to learn how to, you know, kind of meander through them. I'm sure there's some things I'll learn. But same thing with you. Don't never buy at the open. Don't do it. It's crazy. Everybody's rushing in there and buying at the open. You don't need to do it. What else we got to talk about here? Let's see. Okay. So, I wanted to mention to you. This is interesting. So next week we're going to have Fausto Puglisi, he's from Cyber Trading University, talking about day trading. So make sure that you are a part of that. But also I want to mention to you is that, I don't know, I've been doing a little bit more on Twitter, kind of putting a few things out there. Andrew Horowitz is my Twitter name, and I'm on Facebook also. So if you want to kind of do a little communication here and there, I would highly recommend you go over to Twitter. There's some, you know, if you haven't checked it out and use the Twitter clients inside of Firefox, some cool stuff there, and on the iPhone, they're awesome. And a last thing I want to mention to you is if you haven't checked out the new Google Chrome, which is the Google's their first foray into the browser market. I wrote a piece on MSN Money, and I'll put a link in the website. There's a bunch of things I wrote last week on MSN Money that I think are probably good for you to check out, because I'm writing not only for the Strategy Lab, but I'm writing for Top Stocks, my blog. I'm writing a lot of things. All my research is being spread around a little bit. But I wrote about why I'm shorting MasterCard. That's one thing. I also wrote about the whole oil manipulation issue and kind of went through that. And I talked about Google's Chrome. I did some testing of it. I thought it was kind of interesting from my geek side of it, and geek side of things. And I thought it was interesting to see whether or not they're going to actually be any competition to Microsoft. What do you think? I don't know. It's okay. Firefox still is the bomb, isn't it? But anyway, there's so many great plugins for Firefox compared to what this is. I mean, and plus not to mention you can synchronize your bookmarks everywhere. So I don't know why I'd be starting out from scratch on the Google Chrome. I guess it's interesting, but not wonderful. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get on with Jason Calacanis. And I think he's a really interesting guy, and I can't wait to talk to him, to be honest with you. So stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, we are here with a very special guest today. We have Jason McCabe Calacanis, and he is a founder of and CEO of Mahalo. I just did a little stint with him on Twit. We had a lot of fun on that, and let him introduce himself. So, Jason, hey, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, thanks for having me on the program. That was a good time on This Week in Tech.
That was fun. That was the beard poppers with the cream puffs. That you should have been there watching Leo consume these things.
I've been to Beard Papa. It's an addiction, and it's just wrong on so many levels. I don't know what it is with desserts from Asia, but it's like in Los Angeles we have red mango, pink berry, and Beard Papa. All of them have crazy lines. I don't know what it says exactly, but it's really interesting that American culture and Japanese culture and Korean culture are just sort of mixing. So, you know, it's actually kind of beautiful in a way.
It is nice. I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting that I just came back. Actually, I was in Thailand and I was in Hong Kong, and I felt very much at home there, as crazy as that sounds, in some of the areas where they, you know, were sleeping on the floors and there was pigs everywhere. I felt that maybe that wasn't exactly my home, but maybe a distant relative's. But it was, I mean, Thailand was, you've been to Thailand, right?
I have not been to Thailand. Oh. My wife, the summer, was volunteering in an orphanage, like 2 hours deep into the jungle and, you know, rural area. And these people are living in squalor, basically. And she was helping them, try to have sustainable revenue streams for these poor orphaned kids who, you know, basically can't leave the orphanage.
What's interesting there is a lot of the refugees are from Myanmar. And what I really find fascinating about that even more is that most people, when you mention, you know, where is Myanmar, what's going on there, they don't really know. But you say, you know what, they just changed the name from Burma. And they're like, Right. Oh, that place.
Yeah, well, actually, that's what my wife was working with, Burmese refugees. Mm-hmm. And their parents, these kids were either sold into sex slavery or abandoned, or their parents are dead. And they don't have any papers, so they're not... They don't exist, essentially.
Right.
No government will accept them. So basically, they can't even be adopted.
Right.
They can't leave the orphanage right now. It's terrible. Sort of like they're like people without papers. They don't have any documents, from what I understand. And if you want to help them, you have to buy illegal documents of some person their age who died. So some other 8-year-old kid who happened to die, you buy their birth certificate and pretend it's them. And that's like the only way to do it. And it costs $10,000 or something. It's just... unbelievable. It's we live in this world of incredible wealth, and people are obsessing about, you know, Google's latest browser or Steve Jobs' latest feature on the iPhone, and then you start realizing, you know, there are people who just are really suffering in the world. Yep. And it's it we get so detached, you know, whether it's through our belief in capitalism and the financial market that all, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. It does lift all boats in general. And, you know, then some people, you know, it sinks, you know, and they get left behind.
Well, I think all this is about, you know, it really is, you know, we all live in our own little bubble, or, and I mean the bubble in the sense of wealth. It's just our own little, we have our own little issues going on. And, you know, I live in Florida, so when you have a hurricane coming here, it's the most unbelievable thing, and it kind of consumes everything. But if it's just a little bit over to the left, over in Louisiana, like, oh, what's going on over there? Looks interesting. You know, turn to the ball game, you know, and yeah. It's unfortunate. I did spend some time actually with that with the people who are resettled from Burma as well, and it is an absolutely incredible life. They are living on nothing. Their whole existence. Where I went was this little village, and they were cutting up bamboo strips to resell to put on the sides of homes and on the roofs, and they were getting, you know, maybe $2 for this, you know, 4 or 5 days worth of labor. Yep. And it was really, I mean, I'll tell you one thing. When I did go there, and supposedly this is really off the beaten path, most visitors don't go there, they didn't ask me for any money. They didn't ask me for anything. They just wanted a little friendship to talk, and it was really quite beautiful.
My wife said the same thing. She said she couldn't believe, you know, like how much grace, you know, these kids had, and how much poise, and, you know, given their circumstance, that it was sort of like beautiful and disturbing at the same time.
Right. I miss a meal, and life is over. You know, I mean,
exactly. You know, we're like, oh my God, my dry cleaning's late, or why is my iPhone? I forgot my charger for my BlackBerry. It's the end of the world. You know, like,
it's unbelievable.
And then other people work 5 days to make $2, and you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can go on to another uplifting conversation here.
Absolutely.
So you started Mahalo, and Mahalo is kind of, as I see it a little bit, it's kind of a retro situation. You know, where we had a human hand involved in the original Yahoo, right? Where and the original. Website where you had now I'm drawing up the Dimas was the original, where you had the people kind of record. You know, picking and hoping to God that when you sent in your website, someone would find it interesting enough to put it on some directory somewhere. And that was, I think, originally there was like kind of that was AOL and a few of the other guys that were doing that. But and then we've gotten away from that to be web robot and kind of the Googleized, if you will. So you took the situation
all the time, yeah.
Right? So what are you doing differently with Mahalo, which means, I guess, hello in Hawaiian and good day and things like that, right?
So
is that like the Shalom of Hawaii?
Yeah,
Mahalo.
It's the thank you of Hawaii.
Hawaii, thank you.
It's the second most important word in the Hawaiian language. Aloha would be the first hello, and thank you, and sort of goodbye. Some people say Mahalo is sort of a combination, but it's really a deep seated from what I understand, a deep-seated gratitude, a very heartfelt thank you, and sort of spiritual. And I wanted a service that would really help people.
Right.
And so the genesis of it was I was getting married, and we were planning our wedding in Kauai, in Hawaii. And it's a small garden island of Hawaii. And my wife sent an email to people saying, you know, essentially what looked like a search result to me, except it was in sections. It said, you know, here are the expensive hotels, the moderate hotels, and the affordable hotels. Here are the expensive restaurants, the moderate restaurants, the casual restaurants. Here are the adventure tours. Here are the more, you know, slower tours. And here are the beaches. And here are some sites. And I looked at it and I said, wow, and it had links, and it was very clean, and there was no spam in it. And I said, how long did it take you to do this? She said, well, you know, I've been to the island twice, and you know, I bought these three books, and I did a bunch of Google searches, and it took me like an hour to write it, 2 hours. And I said, wow, that's really interesting. 2 hours. 2 hours of an editor's time is at $10 an hour, $20. For $20, she created something that could have been written without ever going there, of course. You know, you could just get this could have just as easily been written by somebody who was never there and be actually as accurate. And it's $20. And I said, wow, if 50 people in our wedding got that, that means they each paid, you know,
right,
50 cents for it or something, and that saved them each 10 minutes. That's a lot of leverage. I mean, when you have a business, you look for leverage, at least I do. And, you know, I built a blogging business and found leverage there. I built a publishing business and a conference business and an email newsletter business and found leverage in combining those things. And I said, wow, I wonder if you could build, you know, 1,000 of these pages for $20,000. And so I started writing them myself, and I realized, gee, these are sort of like a Dimas page. But I was like, what if I write a little content on it, you know? And it sort of feels like a search result. And what if people could add their own links? It'd be sort of like Delicious. And then I was like, maybe people should be able to vote them up and down. And I didn't do that because I found voting is kind of inane and doesn't really work very well.
And you don't know who's voting for what and how accurate it is.
Tons of gaming. It's one of the worst things that ever happened on the web is that, you know, web-based voting people actually think is, you know, accurate proxy for, you know, relevance. It's not. An individual is actually. So the way I describe it is we, on each page, we put a short guide note that is essentially like a Wikipedia page. So in our laboratory, we saw that people would do a Google search, look for the Wikipedia page, go to the Wikipedia page, scan for quick facts, and then go back to Google, and then hit one or two more sites.
Right.
Some advanced users would go to Wikipedia, scan it, and then click on one or two of the reference links at the bottom. Kind of interesting, right?
Right.
And so I said, well, this is what people are doing. It's sort of like they want content and search together.
Mm.
And so I said, well, what if we made the page 50-50, content and links, and had the links all built by humans? It would be the best starting page on the internet for any topic. So, for example, I'm on the website right now, and I'm looking at Levi Johnston, who is an Alaskan teenager. I'm reading from the guide note, who is the father of Bristol Palin's unborn child on September 1st, blah, blah, blah. Candidate admitted that her daughter, Bristol, was pregnant. And here are the facts. He was born in 1991. He lives in Wasala, Alaska. His parents are these people. He plays hockey. Da, da, da. And then on the right hand, I have, oh, here's the Wired article about his MySpace page. Here's the New York Post and the Daily News talking about the Huffington Post. These are all things that Google wouldn't pick up. And Google obviously doesn't have a team of a couple of hundred editors working for it like I do.
Right.
And so is it a search engine built by humans? Yes, but it's also sort of like Wikipedia, and people have a really hard time defining it. What I define it as is these are guide pages. They're 50% Wikipedia, 50% Google. Well, we're never going to have every search you could possibly want to do, but any proper name, any city, any state, any product of note, any breaking news story, any city name plus hotel, or every city name plus, you know, tours we'll probably have. And so over time, we have 100,000 of these pages now. We might have a couple of million of these pages, and then it starts to look like what the Wikipedia would look like if they had brevity and an ownership of words, because, you know, obviously we're paying people.
Right.
So, you know, they do citations and they own the words, and, you know, they get fired if they make a mistake or too many mistakes. You get the idea. Well, so it's a new type of service. It's very confusing to people, which I like. You know, when I started the blogging business, we were the largest blog publisher. Nobody understood what I was doing, and I love it that way. And
people I'm probably alone. Feel bad for me. I really never went to Wikipedia. I mean, I go to Wikipedia. Like, when I say go to Wikipedia, it's just by accident. I will not use anything from Wikipedia. Call me stupid, but, you know, the whole idea that there could be, and I've done it, where you just kind of can change. And today it's different, but where I could just change something on the fly. I don't know if I'm going to get something accurate or whatever. And, it just kind of makes me a little bit nervous. But the thing that really bothers me, I will tell you, is, and I found a recent shortcut on this, but when you go to Google, right, and you put in a search, whatever it is, put in a search, and you just get a hoblob of information that comes out. And what I found really interesting was it's so strange that I'm not getting it in chronological order of the newest first. I mean, we're trying to get relevance, obviously, but isn't there a way to get relevance and date together? And there was no way to do so. There's a little hack that you can do on Google. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you can kind of do it in date
advanced
order.
References, last 24 hours.
Yeah, you could do this whole thing, and then you can kind of like put this whole thing in and whatever, and then it a drop-down list that the page has a drop-down list built into it. Anyway, because search has become it's almost a game that you have to now have an edge in knowing how to search. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, we expect people to be librarians, and actually trust in search is going down,
right?
According to a lot of surveys. 60% of people don't trust search results. And so that's really interesting, and that's gone from 40% just like 2 or 3 years ago. And so, there's something going on here, and so you have to say, well, wait a second, Google's got thousands of PhDs, you're an investor and you cover the market, you know, like every quarter they're like, oh, we're going to stop hiring people, and then they hire another 500 people.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then the next quarter, remember they did that for like three quarters,
yep,
like,
exactly.
Oh yeah, we're going to slow down, and they just kept hiring more.
Right.
They're hiring a lot of people because there's a lot of problems to solve, and it seems like it's not working. So how is that possible? They've got more people than ever, and the results are getting bad. The reason is there's a ton of bad actors in the space doing what's called search engine optimization, SEO, to put bad results and mix up the results that are there. And if you look at just 10 years ago in, you know, 98, 99, 2000, you know, in 2000 there might have been 1,000 pages about, you know, Kauai, Hawaii. Today there might be 100 million. And it's really hard for Google to know which is better and which is worse. And it's the equivalent of, you know, if you asked some, if you, you wouldn't ask a computer which sushi restaurant is best, right?
Right.
You might ask them, or which movie is best. You might ask them, what time is the movie playing? Where can I get tickets? Who's in it? You know, where's the restaurant? What are their hours? You know, there's a lot of things that computers can do well, but refined curation is not one of them. And so that's what I see our role is. We're going to take the top 20% of search, mm-hmm. you know, the top 20% of searches where a lot of the money is made, and we're going to make those a lot better.
Right.
And then we'll have machine search for everything else. So if we don't have a result, we'll give you machine search. Nothing is lost.
So let's kind of segue into the future, because, you know, this is an investment show, and I want to talk about, like, where are we going with investment? Now, Google, with that in mind, Google stock has been sagging, at least, you know, pretty substantially since it had that huge spike earlier in this year, as many of the technology companies are, as is the economy, blah, blah. But Google just came out with, recently came out with this thing called Google Chrome. I don't know if it was really, I guess it was in the back burners there somewhere that we've heard about this. We heard about that and their other initiative, which we're all kind of excited about, or semi-excited about, is Android, their phone operating system, if you will. But Google Chrome, do you think this has something to do with the fact that they realize that search is kind of becoming a little bit less sexy, less profitable, less of, you know, Google only out there, and they need to do something to kind of capture things?
Well, every company needs a second act, right? I mean, and if you look at Microsoft as a company, you know, their first act was the operating systems. The second act was Office.
Right.
And, you know, they've got some third acts and servers and maybe small mini ones brewing now with, like, video games, although those don't really move the needle for them. And it's very hard for a company to have a second act. As you know, most companies have, like, one thing they do really well, and that's it. And then the paradigm shifts, and they... And they're screwed. Google realizes that search is, you know, their big hit. Really, the ad network around search is the hit, not the search itself. Google AdSense, which you see those mm-hmm. ads across the entire web, not right. just on Google. And so they're trying to figure out, okay, where can we have our next hit? That's why they're doing Gmail. That's why they're, you know, doing their Office, you know, suite of programs. And that's why they're going to do other pieces. They don't know which one's going to break out, but they know that if they... you know, do these extra projects, and they send a little bit of traffic to their core ad network business that's virtuous. And if they do have one breakout, like the browser, like their Office suite, you know, it could be a big game changer. So,
yeah, but if they have the Office suite, and, you know, right now there's no revenue model on it, and I don't even see where the revenue model would be the way they're setting it up. You know, you can't, you know, listen, Jason, listen, do we call you a serial entrepreneur? Is that you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I love that. Good.
After so, you do what, two, you're serial.
You're serial. So you're a serial entrepreneur and a successful one. And, you know, but so now the thing about the new model starting in 1999, the old model of business was you create a business, you have a product, you sell the product. If you're successful, you're making money, et cetera, and more people come because they like the product, blah, blah. Right? Okay. The new model is you build something, you bring a lot of people, don't charge them anything at all, okay? You just bleed out your money left and right until hopefully somehow you can figure a way to make money from it. Is that kind of put it in a nutshell?
Yeah, so much. I mean, what something happened between the Web 1.0 era and the Web 2.0 era. And you put the crash right in between the two, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had businesses, one business before it and two businesses after it. And in the early days of the internet, there were a lot of questions like, will people use the internet? Will there be broadband? Will advertisers use it? Will people be willing to put their credit card on the internet? These are big questions.
Mm-hmm.
Web 2.0, those questions have been answered. If you have traffic, you will make money from advertising. So what that's done is it's – and also the cost structure of the internet has changed rapidly. In the beginning days of the internet, you know, the first thing you do with your $10 million raise is give $1 million of it to Oracle and $1 million of it to your server farms, to Sun or something, and you'd spend $2 or $3 million setting up your infrastructure for your website.
Mm-hmm.
That was day one, year one.
Right.
Now you host it on Google App Engine or Amazon EC2 and you spend nothing,
right.
close to nothing.
Yeah, few thousand a month or something like that. Whatever.
Yeah, or maybe if you're a scale business like we are, you buy $100,000 in servers like we have, $100,000.
Right. Well, that gets you a big package. I mean, you're set.
We talk about 40 servers, two right. racks, and we pay right. $5,000 a month for bandwidth. So, you know, and we have almost 5 million unique visitors coming to our site a month, so we're already a pretty at-scale business. So
right.
it's really, the economics have changed tremendously to the point at which people say, you know what, just get the traffic and then figure it out. YouTube got the traffic, they figured it out. Facebook got the traffic, Dig got the traffic, then you figure it out. Because everybody knows you can make money advertising. So it's not as frivolous and crazy as it sounds. In the early days, it was a little bit crazy, right? People spent all this money, did all this advertising, hoping people would come, hoping people would, you know, spend advertising. So it was a little bit of a flyer, thus the opportunity. Today, it's not really that much of a flyer. I mean, you get to 10 million uniques a month and, you know, 20, 30, 40 million page views, you can very accurately predict how much money you're going to make, $5 to $25 per 1,000 page views. It's pretty simple.
But the problem is now that I don't know about you, but everything I see is that banner clicks are down. The cost for banners, the actual cost of per click through, is ridiculously low. And you know, with this kind of economic, you know, the other thing you rely on, by the way, is also potentially.
That's only because that's a misleading statistic. You have to have the other half of the statistic, which is $1 billion is moving over into online every year and has been doing so for many years, and we're just getting started.
You're talking about sales. Retail sales.
Yeah. Oh, no. Advertising.
Okay,
from television,
I gotcha,
and radio and outside to coming over to the internet, and it's $20 billion this year, and so, or something to that effect. So it's, you know, yes, the cost per click may be going down and banner ads may not be as effective, but that's just all, you know, things that happen in media that, you know, people refine, you know, the tools. And if as long as the large number is going up, that's the issue. So,
right.
Yeah, Google might make less per click, but their revenue is still growing.
Right.
And their earnings are getting better. So
about,
I wouldn't worry.
About Google, I'm trying to interrupt you, but this Google Chrome thing, so I it's interesting to me. I think I like to look at, okay, what's the other side of this whole thing? Do you think that Google is going to be, you know, I wrote in this piece, I said, I wrote it for MSN Top Stocks today, and I said, you know, obviously subliminal advertising, generally speaking, is illegal. But when you look at advertising that is based on some kind of an algorithm that looks at probability maps of what you've bought before and what you may want to buy in the future, a la Amazon, you know, hey, these are the books you may like. You know, do you think that, you know, one of the things that Google's doing here is if they build this app with built-in abilities to track where you've been and to look at your likes and dislikes reported back to Google. Because did you download Google Chrome yet?
You know, I'm on my Mac right now. I have to do it on my Mac at home where I have Parallels, because it's only Windows today.
It's only Windows, right. So I downloaded on my Windows machine, and it said something to the effect of, do you want to optionally put some statistic package in there? Which then, again, yields to me the fact that they're going to know much more about my experience. And it would seem to me that they're trying to really, you know, step it up to find out, you know, if they can do some of these predictive buying patterns, you know, and if they can kind of...
Yeah, I mean, listen, the more data they have, the better they can target the ads, which means the increase in click-through and the increase in closing the transaction. The issue is, you know, there are different cognitive situations online where you are more acceptive and receptive to advertising than others. So the reason Google has been such a juggernaut is because when you're searching for the first time in any media advertising in the history of the universe, you are putting a word into a box, hitting search, and you've explicitly stated through that gesture that you are interested in something,
mm-hmm,
whatever that word was. It
right.
could be that you're interested in Britney Spears naked. It could be you're interested in a Volvo or a Volvo 36-month lease. And you know, that is magic. You know,
right.
Never before could a Volvo dealer in Santa Monica know that somebody that very moment was interested in a Volvo Santa Monica 36-month lease. And never before could they actually pay only for that advertising in that moment. That's why Google is the greatest company, you know, could ultimately become the greatest company in the history of, you know, the United States in terms of industry, or definitely in the top 10, along with Microsoft and some other ones. So it's pretty epic what they've done in terms of that moment. Now, what people are trying to do, the holy grail, is to say, okay, when you're not cognitively making that explicit gesture, can we also target to you? So when you're mm-hmm. in Facebook talking to your friends, or when you're on ESPN, you know, can we give you that same Volvo ad because we know that you were searched for it before and you were on the Volvo site and you clicked on the 36-month lease? Can we take that behavior from the browser and then target ads? And that would be interesting if they can. You know,
I think they'll have to, a bit of a disclosure would have to happen there, though.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what? The truth is, most people don't mind because it's being done totally anonymously,
mm-hmm.
and it's only for commerce things. So it's not like your porn searches are going to all of a sudden direct you to, you know, some pornographic ads.
Right.
You know, what's the cost if they know you're looking for, you know, a Prius? You know, you're going to see only Prius ads? Okay, well, you know, that's better than seeing, you know, SUV ads if you don't like SUVs. So it's sort of one of these issues where privacy nets get a little crazy. But if you peel back the onion, you know, they're anonymizing the information, and they can't put a name to it that easily.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was on one of, you know how they could do an IP-based kind of lookup when you're on a site, right? So I'm on a site, and I don't know, I was doing something, and all of a sudden, on the left-hand side, all of these very attractive women were kind of seemingly talking to me, and they were all seemingly from my town or exactly where I was. And so my wife walks in and says, "What are you doing?" I'm like, it is not what it looks like.
Right. I know that these all say they're in Brentwood.
And I'm not kidding about this. It really is not. And it's like, well, why are they? I don't know how they got there.
What they've basically done is they've built databases of IP addresses. So they have geotargeting services. So you came from a certain IP address. We know that that IP address is from a cable modem in Brentwood or Santa Monica, and we're going to target you ads for the Santa Monica dealer. So you did Volvo, and you're in Santa Monica, so it's going to be the Volvo Santa Monica. And you know, that's going to get more, you know, and then as the pendulum swings that way, you know, the browsers are now going to have privacy or porn mode, as they call them. You're going to be able to just do that. And then there's another trend that will come, which is, you know, private browsing. There's something called Tor, T-O-R, a Tor server. And this is really interesting, open source. You can go to torproject.org, the listeners can. And what this is doing is it routes your requests through these anonymous servers. And so it's really cool software that you can turn on and off really easily. Of course, the downside to it, and it encrypts everything. So your request goes to a Tor server. That Tor server makes a request to another Tor server. And that other Tor server only knows that the request came from that other Tor server, not who it was from. You get the idea.
Yep.
So this is how child pornography and freedom fighters and terrorists and people in China who are political refugees are able to communicate. And so it's a really hot potato issue, and it's going to be something that you'll see more of as more and more people get busted for, you know, downloading free, you know, stolen music or movies, or people, you know, have their information compromised. Anonymous browsing. If there was a company that, you know, made an anonymous browser, you know, or an ISP that guaranteed anonymity, I think it would be a huge hit.
It would be big. But then I have obviously inherent problems with that. Let me ask you about TechCrunch 20. Are you still involved with that TechCrunch?
Yeah, TechCrunch 50 this year. So it's a pretty basic conference. The idea is 50 companies launch. It's next week, September 8th, 9th, and 10th in San Francisco. And Mike Arrington, who runs the TechCrunch blog, which is like powerhouse blog of Web 2.0, and I were having dinner with a guy named Steve Gilmore, and I was telling Mike how to, you know, I used to run conferences and they did well, and he said, well, run one with me. And I said, I have an idea for one. And they, you know, what if we did the, you know, a demo style conference? There's another conference called Demo, where instead of the companies paying 20,000 demo charges, 18,500 for 6 minutes on stage, we let people demo for free based on merit. And so we had 900 people apply. We picked the best 50 companies. And last year, one of the companies that launched at the event was PowerSet, bought by Microsoft for $100 million. And two of the other ones, Mint, which actually won the event. The event has a $50,000 grand prize. Mint won last year, and Cake Financial is doing well. So, and there's two or three other companies in the TechCrunch 40 from last year that are going to be bought in the next couple of months, from what we understand. So the companies that presented last year, the 40 companies raised $160 million in the last year. So it's a pretty epic conference. It's sponsored by Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, Sequoia Capital.
Mike's not happy with me.
Oh, really?
He's not happy
with me either. Don't worry about
it. Yeah, he was supposed to be on the show. We talked back and forth, and what happened was there was some blog post on his site somewhere, and I don't remember exactly. Oh, it was. I think it was on Howard Lindzen's site, and I was just like, I said, "What? This is such crap." And I wrote something to the effect of that. You know, blogging, the blogging concept of blogging has created a jungle of jackasses that just write whatever they want for the effect. And I was really focusing primarily, to be honest with you, on a one such gentleman that is I think his name is Robert Scobel, and. Maybe a friend of yours or not, I don't know. But the thing is, I found a lot of his stuff to be very obnoxious, and maybe that's what he wants to do, because he gets, you know, he's all about the title and he's all about, you know, getting people to look and see and do and all that. And I get that; that's his whole purpose in life, right? But I was really and then he went. I guess he went back and read that somehow, and he called me back and says, "Andrew, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't do this. You kind of insulted me." I said, "No. I wasn't insulting you. You were in that." You were in that block of discussion there, but it wasn't directed at you. And whatever.
I mean, it's a very contentious place, and people lack empathy when they blog. Like Howard Lindzen, I think he's a friend of yours.
No, I didn't say that. No. Let me say this: that he was a gentleman who I once had an acquaintance, and let's just say that that's not the case.
Okay,
you can say whatever you want, my friend, because I'm right with you.
No, I just think he's an idiot. I mean, he basically he wrote this whole thing about how Dig was the most worthless site on the planet, and it's like, you know, for a guy who the best he's ever done in his career is create a little, web show, Wall Strip, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but I mean, he's telling Dig, which gets 30 million uniques a month, is making tens of millions of dollars a year, that, it's the biggest failure in the world. I was like, what? And I realized, oh, he's just link baiting.
Yeah.
And, that's the thing about this. On that's the reason I retired from blogging, was because it was just the whole thing is just, when it started, people were really in it because they wanted to have a voice and they wanted to discuss stuff and be in conversation. And then idiots like Howard Lindzen get involved and these other people, and they go, oh, I have to link bait. Everything I do has to kick somebody else in the nuts in order to get a reaction, because I get no comments on my blog. And if I attack Jason Calacanis or Kevin Rose, I'm going to get comments. You know, nobody reads Howard Lindzen's blog. Right. Nobody cares. I had 20,000 people a day reading my blog. I have 5,000 people on my email list. I have 37,000 people on my Twitter. People are listening to what I'm saying.
Right.
Therefore, how does somebody who has no audience Howard do something?
It's very simple. It's all about timing. Anybody can be a genius for a period of time. When he was talking about, and I don't want to even, we may even cut this whole section about Howard Lindzen out, but, when we talk about,
leave it in.
When we talk about, the whole thing about, riding the winners and take the guy, the companies that are at the top of their price range and the highest ever, and buy those. You're waiting for disaster. I mean, just absolute disaster. You don't have to be, a financial genius and investment guru to know that, you start buying companies that are at the top all over the place and is running kind of on just fumes at this point. You can be in real trouble. And anybody can say whatever they want.
If it was the case, then you just used a bad example, because Dig makes over $10 million a year in revenue, and they're doing fantastic. They're one of the ones that's actually gotten to scale. That has over 20, 30 million uniques a month.
Right.
That's a real business, you know? Facebook, you say what you want about them and the $15 billion valuation. Obviously, that's a silly valuation. 100 million people going to it, it's significant. So
what's the future here? What's the future of, in terms of, now let's talk publicly, conceptually, not only VC stuff. What's publicly, what's going to happen where I'm an average investor? What should I be looking for? Am I looking for the Googles? Am I looking to kind of get away from, maybe some of the CRM companies, the cloud stuff, or get in? I mean, what should I be looking for?
Well, the truth be told, a lot of the best companies don't want you to go public anymore.
Right.
It's just too much of a hassle. It's much easier to make an exit to a Microsoft, Google, Oracle, whatever, big media company. And so I think a lot of those stocks that people used to like to play and used to like to get in early on, they don't really exist as much. I mean, there's very few IPOs, obviously. And if somebody does IPO, it's because they have a very, very, very mature business, right? 100 million in revenue plus, 50 million in revenue plus. It's not anybody's going to go public pre-revenue or whatever. They're going to have earnings and a really good top line. So I think the individual investors, and I am not a big stock trader myself, are going to need to look internationally for those type of opportunities, because I just don't think the U.S. entrepreneurs nor VCs want to be public anymore.
Yeah, Sarbanes-Oxley just killed the whole thing. And then on top of that, the truth is that, and I will tell you this, just to kind of put in the back of your head, and if it comes up, the last couple of IPOs that I've seen come out that have just come out and flopped, I think what's happening, by the way, is one of the things that the Goldmans and the Morgans and the distributors of it and at every tier were supposed to hold the stock up when it came out, right? Remember that? That was part of their job. They can't do that anymore financially. When I say they can't, they can't. They have other things they need to deal with. So if you're coming out public right now, I think you're just looking for disaster, initially.
Right.
Problematic. Yeah. So what's the best thing that you see come? I mean, what do you think about Silverlight versus Flash?
I don't think Silverlight's going to be that much of a game changer. Flash has got a pretty good install base, so I still like Macromedia and Adobe's products. They're great.
I love that. It seems like a lifetime ago from Macromedia to Adobe. That was one of the great, by the way, Adobe's on my my buy list. We're buying Adobe all over the place right now for our clients. I love Adobe.
You know, people specialize. There's something about specialization, you know, and not biting off more than you can chew that can lead to excellence, you know, and mm-hmm. as Adobe just makes, you know, a really good suite of products for a certain vertical. And, you know, even Apple is that way. You know, they're like, yeah, we're not going to give the hardware business out over to anybody else, and we're going to release products relatively slowly. I mean, they've had a lot of products backed up. The one I keep hearing about, and I've been actually was predicting and keep hearing buzz about, is Apple going into the TV business. And I'm absolutely certain Apple will, in a year time frame, have a, you know, 40-inch LCD TV.
Oh, you're talking about the hardware. Oh, interesting.
I'm talking about a television set.
Right. Wow.
Except your television set's got a computer in it.
Hmm.
And you plug Ethernet into it, plug Wi-Fi into it, and your interface is, you know, the iTunes store, you know, except a little bit sexier, you know. And that's going to be I think that's the end game for Apple right now, is to get your television set. And you can imagine how beautiful your computer is, your iMac is, how beautiful your MacBook Air, your iPhone is. Imagine you just like walk into your room and your television room, and you pull out your iPhone, and it knows you're standing in front of your TV, and you just scroll through and you pick a video on your computer, or you pick a TV channel from a thing, or you download a movie from their iTunes store immediately on HD and start watching it. I mean, game over.
Right.
You don't need a cable box. Throw away your cable.
Well, you just hit the. I mean, you don't know this about me, but that's you just hit two of them. Apple is the number one holding for all of our portfolios for our clients, actually, across the board, which is kind of cool. So, what's interesting about that is that, you know, as I say, during recessionary times and problematic times in terms of economies really failing, the number one business you want to be oftentimes is in alcoholic beverages, you know, for all sorts of reasons. I'm not kidding about that either. For all sorts of reasons.
Consumables are protected, right? The consumables don't change, right?
Right, right. The second thing is unfortunately, there's a couple other oddball ones out there. But the other thing is basically personal entertainment. That's a great place to be as well. I mean, if the pricing structure is right, et cetera. And Apple has really set the stage. Do you have an iPhone, by the way?
Yeah, I'm looking down on it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's just, you know.
I'm a BlackBerry guy, but I carry my iPhone as well because I like surfing the web on it. I like listening to music on it. I like playing Texas Hold'em Poker on it.
Mm-hmm.
The App Store is ridiculous. It's just insane.
Oh, my God. You get to spend all day on it. I got to get myself away from it sometimes, the App Store. It's unbelievable. The things that you can buy and do, and now, do you see the ruler? You can use a ruler and measure very large objects. They use a calculation that you put a little credit card next to it, and you can kind of take a picture of it, and then it does.
Oh, that's ridiculous!
Yeah, that's really cool. But okay, so let me just close up on this point with you that I think is really interesting. Two things. Number one, so you created the whole weblogs and the whole area, I guess, which is the competition in a way to TechCrunch, which is on the other side.
Well, TechCrunch was business to business. We were in Gadget, Autoblog, Joystick. I picked all the top advertising categories and matched them to blogs. And
right.
At that point, there was nobody in those verticals. So we were, you know, either the first or second into those verticals, and we wound up being the number one in those verticals.
And I wrote for AOL, by the way. I think I told you that. I wrote for Blogging Stocks for a while, and it was interesting, although it was, you know, it was littered with ads, and it was okay. They have one of truly my opinion, they have a great little infrastructure with the editors and all that to do it, but they've kind of since really compressed and gotten rid of, I guess, some of the pieces that don't work. You're not in that anymore, in that whole business. You sold that off to AOL.
18 months after we started.
That's right. And so what's the kind of that whole play? I mean, blogging and all that is here to stay, or is it kind of peaking out and it's going to kind of come all the way back where, like, when we had brick and mortar kind of was quiet for a while and they came back? Do you think that the big guys, you know, whether it's the major companies, that they are going to take that over, or do you think this is here to stay?
I think blogging is going to be around for a long time. You know, it's part of the fabric now. So it's a unique format, you know, like rap music is, you know, and people didn't know if that was staying power.
I hope
it does.
I hope not.
Well, whatever. I mean, listen, they didn't think rock and roll was going to stick either. They didn't think opera was going to stick. You know, there's a long history of, you know, people poo-pooing certain verticals, and then they stick, you know, and blogging is an acoustic, you know, nobody between you and the publish key, for better or worse. You know, you can drunk blog, you can angry blog, you can happy blog, you know, and you sort of see people's true colors through it. You know, some people are insightful and brilliant. Other people are, you know, goofy and, you know, that's sort of the nice part about it. Although the level of noise is truly, truly
deafening,
unbelievable, and it I think it is not psychologically healthy to blog for an extended period of time.
Right. Well, you just quit not too long ago. You kind of just hung up your blogging
tools. Doing it for 5 years, and I was like, you know what? Love everybody in blogging. Love reading blogs. Still read blogs. I'm just tired of the same 10 to 20, you know, mentally disturbed to hater type people following me everywhere I go to write these like absurd comments, and then all the intelligent people don't take part in it. You know, the analogy I use is, you know, you go to Carnegie Hall and some, you know, incredible maestro puts on this virtuoso performance, and then you go into the back alley and find it, you know, the drunkest bum and say, oh, did you overhear any of that? And they say, I think I heard something. You take them on stage, and then they take their pants down and take a huge dump and say, you know, you guys, and leave. And that's like your critique of the performance. They're like, that's blogging, you know, like that's the comment section on blogs.
Yep.
The weirdest, drunkest, dumbest, mentally ill people going insane. And I literally have mentally ill people who were stalking me. I was just like, what am I doing? I'm like engaging mentally ill people. So I moved to an email newsletter, 5,000 people sign up. I email them my thoughts, and anywhere between 50 and 200 people respond back to just me, and they are like the most intelligent CEOs, VP level, investor level people writing 4 paragraphs just to me.
Right.
And that does more for a guy like me than being public. I'm as public as I'm ever going to be in the internet industry. So why not have these incredible deep relationships? And that's what blogging was supposed to be in the beginning, but it just got too noisy.
When I write something and they don't like what I said, they start picking on the fact that I didn't have a comma where it should be, and trying to, you know, talk about if you can't have a comma where it's supposed to be, where how should I trust you to recommend an investment for me? I'm like, what? What are you talking about? This is not supposed to be Mr. Perfect, you know, grammar and penmanship. You know, it's supposed to be information that you can use. But all right, let's close it up because I know you're busy and I got to get going. But where do you see the next great technology in the future, aside from the TV? With Apple, where do you see kind of what is really like? You know, you have this TechCrunch.
I think the real future is cloud computing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a new term that I've been working on, which is sky computing, which you can obviously extend the metaphor, which is when you have multiple clouds out there of, you know, services, what does the sky look like, and how does that sort of all interconnect? And that's really where it's going to get interesting. So, you know, people are going to be hosting their applications, their lives, all the different services, either on Google or Amazon's EC2, you know, I'm long Amazon. I think that's going to be a big business for them. They'll probably spin it out at some point. You get some shares in that.
Mm-hmm.
And Kindle, I think, is going to be a huge hit. I think every college is going to be based on Kindle. You're going to go to Harvard and get a Kindle.
Mm. Do you have a Kindle, by the way?
I'm waiting for number 2 because it was sold out when I went to buy it, and I was like, I know number 2 is coming out, so I figured I'd buy number 2.
I have a Kindle. I'm just my book is on Kindle, by the way. Although I have no idea how anybody gets paid from this because it's a totally different division that is totally disjointed from Amazon. They need to kind of bring it together, but Kindle's unbelievable device.
They got some things to go brewing with that Kindle that are going to be truly epic, like, you know, that you buy a book and you get the audio book as well, and you know, you stop reading. Imagine you read chapter 1, you hit pause, you press a key and go to the audio version, and it starts you start listening to the second chapter. You stop in the middle of the second chapter, you pick it back up, press the button, and the audio is following the words on the page, so you could actually be reading it and listening to it at the same time. That I guarantee you they're going to do with Audible, and it's going to be a pretty amazing integration. And then imagine you're a student, you go to college, and they're like, here's your Kindle, and give us $500, and you have all your textbooks. Boom. Can you imagine the profit margin
that
for these textbooks?
That is huge. Because, you know, obviously it's a great device. I mean, it could use a couple little feature enhancements, in my opinion. But, you know,
the beta.
Right. But it's great. No, it's a great device. And what I like about it is it's coded for me. I mean, I go onto the Amazon store from there. It says, hello, Andrew, what do you want? You know, and I just click the button, and 30 seconds later, I have a book, or, you know, you could read your blogs right from there, Wall Street Journal, whatever it is. I mean, that is a really cool device, and I agree with you. That is the next generation, because who needs to carry around an entire backpack of books when you have this opportunity? So that's cool. Great. Very nice. All right. Well, awesome. we'll check back soon. I'm sure I'm going to be on Twit once again. We can do our little tete-a-tete. I thought we had fun that time. I really do.
Good time. Leo's an awesome host.
Yeah. Do you remember that poor Peter guy couldn't get a word in edgewise with us, but...
Yeah, it happens.
What about, finally, what's going on with you? Did you see the new car from Aston Martin? I wrote about that the other day. Did you see that?
Oh, the $1 million one they're
million
doing?
Seven.
Million seven. Yeah, that's getting silly. I mean, I like cars. I have the number 16 Tesla coming in 2 weeks. And I'm getting the electrical pack put in, and I've got a Corvette, and I'm going to trade the Corvette in for the new $100,000 625 horsepower Corvette. So I like cars, but I'm not an idiot. You know, like,
yeah. How far does a Tesla go on one juice up?
220 miles, and depending if how you drive. If you drive like me, I think it might go 100.
Right.
But if you drive like Grandma, it might go 250. So I'm going to play with it a whole bunch.
And this is the same industry that last week asked for the government, for Ford, GM, $50 billion to help create more efficient, fuel-efficient cars because they don't have the technology yet. Nobody has technology. And they need $50 billion.
But a startup company with $150 million in investment is delivering cars.
Right. But
so, you know, if ever there was an evidence that we need to have less government involvement, there's your case study. I mean, airlines and the bailouts of incompetent executives at airline companies, the bailout of car companies, let them fail so that these new upstarts can come into the market and have more efficiency. Can you imagine if, you know, the government came in to save Yahoo's market share, you know, and was like, oh, we have to pump $50 billion or $5 billion into Yahoo's market share, you know, efforts to compete with Google. It's idiotic.
Right there, I think, is what is the biggest problem what's going to happen on market. A lot of people are believing that every company is too big to fail. And when it comes to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, when it comes to the car companies, just take your pick of what you'd like in the banking industry, whatever it is. The fact is most people think it's not going to happen, and they have this underlying belief that it's just going to be okay and all that. But once they start seeing some of these things happen, and, you know, we may see Fannie and Freddie bailed out of some sort, you know, we got to realize it can't be everybody.
I'm 100% cash and bonds.
That's beautiful. Well, you know what? When you get through the Tesla, when you're looking for a big money manager, you know.
For a year and a half I've been, because I knew this market was coming apart.
It's coming apart, my friend. It's an ugly situation. All right, listen,
Jason. When do you buy back in? I got to get something out of this call. When do we buy back in?
When do you buy back in? I think that right now you can buy back in. I do believe this, that you can buy back in, not just throw your money in a mutual fund, walk away, buy back in, okay? I'm talking about if you can be selective.
I got Bernstein. Bernstein's a really good manager. Like, do you think I should let Bernstein go, you know, balance the portfolio? Yeah,
I mean, Bernstein's really great, and they're only value, if you remember way back, they only had value for a long time, then they bought American Capital, I think it was, to bring it in, and you know, have the growth side of things. They're very good. I got to tell you something, though. Those guys, they're just overgrown. It depends on how much money and what we're dealing with, but they're overgrown mutual funds. And right now, you need to have just so much more finesse in these markets. I believe this. You just have to have a lot more finesse. And that's why, you know, when we're buying Aeropostale, but we're also throwing a call on top of it, and we're short MasterCard, we're short Capital One, but we're long Adobe, long Apple. I mean, you just kind of really finesse this thing. And most of the guys don't do that. Even, I don't think Bernstein, I mean, maybe some of their accounts, they don't do a lot of the major hedging. Right now, that's the key, is to be, you know, fully hedged. And I think that not run with...
So give up some upside, but have some downside protection.
Yeah, I think that's the best, absolutely the best. I call that my skyscraper approach to investing, which is quickly you go into a skyscraper in New York City, go in the elevator, 5 floors on the way down, 100 on the way up. That's how we want your portfolio to react, right? We want to make sure that you have limited downside, but you know, have a good amount of upside. And but I'll talk to you offline. I'll send you a couple of things to get you going on that. And we're looking forward. By the way, anybody listening out there, Jason doesn't exactly know this, but I've asked some of his crew to help me with my Mahalo page to make it all sorts of spiffiness. And I'm going to send people over to Mahalo to check it out from our site. Check out Mahalo. Thank you, Jason Calacanis. And I look forward to talking to you soon, buddy.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, that was fun. Jason's a good guy, and I do encourage you to visit Mahalo, and you gotta check it out a little bit and see what's going on there. It's a little bit different than probably you've seen in terms of search engines and places where you can kind of look at things in total. I'll give you a link on our site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, for my page, the Mahalo page that they put together for me. It looks kind of cool. Add what you will on it. It's kind of, a project in process. And other than that, we have, like I said, a very interesting week ahead of us. And I want you to be prepared for opportunities. We will post some information on our blog on some of the things that we're doing. And, of course, we'll be updating the MSN Strategy Lab and MSN Top Stocks blog. We put some pieces up this weekend on the earnings to look out for next week. Particularly, Apple is coming out with a meeting or has a meeting on Tuesday. And some of the things that we need to look for if you are a holder of Apple shares, I would encourage you to take a look at that and just to be aware of some of the things that are going on, some stocks to short, some stocks to long, et cetera. Other than that, we're going to sign off. The show got a little long today. And if you have any questions, you know where to find me. Make sure to get me on your Twitter at Andrew Horowitz, and I'll be happy to tweet, I guess they call it. Other than that, I want you to have a very safe week. It's going to be a wild one, as usual. I guess it's been that way, and I've been saying that in closing for a long time now. But that's the truth. It's going to be a little crazy. And if you want to take a look at what we're doing in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, of course, go over to the site, click on where it says the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, take you on a 14-minute virtual tour of what we're doing. I think you'll enjoy it. Go check it out if you have some time, and if you're kind of disgusted with what's gone on in your portfolio with your current portfolio manager and whoever it is, I think you'd enjoy with what you know learning about what the strategy does, and it'll probably, if nothing else, give you some ideas of an insight what you could do on your own, if nothing else. So do that, and then we'll see you next week when we have a day trading course and a day trading discussion, I should say, with Fausto Puglisi from Cyber Trading University. Thanks a lot, gang. Have a good day. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.